Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to view the landscape of income taxes, what might happen, what might be taken away. I don't know if we'll spend a lot of time on what will be given, but to lead us in that discussion is Tom O'Rourke, attorney at law, partner Miles and Stockbridge, and a tax attorney, former IRS, and actually got me into this radio gig 35 years ago.
It's been a long time, Whoa. Bob. I was trying to think of that, and I know it was at least in the early 90s or possibly earlier than that. So it's been a long time.
Okay, 22. Thank you. All righty. So, Tom, I'm an accountant and always call you when I get into the deeper end of the pool. But let's stay out of the deeper end most of the show. But we'll go in there on occasion. But we're looking at an election, and it seems that Congress and would not be passing any major tax legislation prior to the election. But how do they then do it after the election? We're not going to talk about that and with the proverbial lame duck. Or do they extend the Bush tax cuts? None of that you and I know. But
That's right.
We do know that if there is inactivity, there are certain major things that are going to happen January 1st, and our listening audience needs to be aware. Now, we're not talking about major things in the stratosphere that only affects the, you know, the 1%. We're talking about things that would affect anybody listening. So let's jump into it. What might be lost if there's inactivity?
Well, the one thing that will happen is everybody who has any income, if you earn $10 and nothing gets done between now and the end of the year in Congress, your taxes are going up. Everybody. Back in 2001 and 2003, right after President Bush was elected, a number of tax cuts were passed. Those tax cuts all remained in effect through 2010. When those tax cuts were about to expire, they were extended for 2 years until December 31st, 2012, which is rapidly approaching. Unless Congress takes some action by the end of this year, there will be significant tax increases for everybody. For example, One of the changes will be one of the changes that took place back in 2003, a new 10% tax bracket was added. If you're a single individual, the first $8,000 of your income is taxed at 10%. If you're married and you file a joint return, about the first $17,000. That goes away. The 10% tax bracket is eliminated. The lowest tax bracket will be 15%. So everybody's going to see, could see, the first $8,000 to $17,000 of their income taxed at a 5% higher rate.
Okay, now this was, I believe, is this known as the Bush tax cuts?
Right. The tax cuts that were enacted in 2001 and 2003 are what are generically referred to as the Bush tax cuts. Of course, back in 2003 when Congress passed these, nobody ever thought we were ever going to get to 2010 and these were going to run out, so Congress did nothing. Congress and the president together in 2010 decided to postpone the hard decisions until 2012. Well, we're at 2012, and the one thing the president has consistently said is he does not want to raise the taxes on lower or middle-income people. The Republicans in Congress have said, we don't want to raise taxes on anybody. There's no agreement, no consensus on what's going to happen. And if there can't be a consensus, if a consensus isn't reached by the end of the year, it's going to be a problem for everybody.
Not many months ago, that was redoing my tax section for the seminars and was looking for an answer as to what taxes might be. And something hit me out of the blue and it said, you know, they do budgets based on tax revenues into the future. And those budgets must be based on some type of change in the tax rate. So I actually drilled into enough websites, and I found it. And it was just what the budget had been based on. And it was somewhat like what you were saying. There was going to be a lessening of the benefits for the Bush tax cuts at the higher end. And also, they were going to... I won't say hit, I won't say clip, but they were going to impact the middle and even lower income a little bit as well. But you know, I can't base any comments on that because that was probably a year ago.
Well, and as you and I both know, these things change every single day. The projection I got, I'm reading from something that was published by Commerce Clearinghouse, which really keeps folks like you and I up to date on what's happening. And they project that if the only change that is made is to increase the rates to what they were in 2003, that will raise an additional $363 billion. So we're talking about real money. If all of the Bush tax cuts are allowed to expire, that could result in increased revenue of something like $4.6 trillion over the next, I believe it's 5 years. So we're talking about very, very substantial amounts of increased revenue, which translates into an increased tax burden for everybody who pays taxes.
Okay, so let's talk to our listeners now. Just let's use your example. The 10% bracket goes away and becomes the 15% bracket. And as Tom mentioned, this is everybody that files a tax return. So on $10,000 of taxable income, that's $500. Right there.
That's right.
And then as I use this analogy, tax rates are like walking upstairs. Ground level is the least level, which will no longer be 10. It'll be now 15%. And then you step up to the next step, and they greet you with a higher tax. They don't go back and retax the other money, so it's kind of stepped. And each one of the steps are going to increase. Now, I don't want us to come across as doom and gloomers, but people need to be aware that they're going to be impacted. Or will it cause them not to be able to eat? No. Will it cause them not to be able to go to the movies? No. But they have to put it in their budget. And I find, and I'm sure that you find as well, in the retirement seminars and the mid-career seminars and the beginning career seminars, when you talk about tax brackets, oftentimes they go, no, when you go into the next higher bracket, my friend lost money. No, it's a marginal jump, except for one of them. One of them really jumps from 15 right. to 25. But it's, you know, the next highest amount might be 3 or 4% higher than what it was. Still high, but it isn't the myth about they go back and retax all the other money.
That's right. I've heard the same thing. I don't want to get a raise because I'm actually going to lose money because I'm in a higher tax bracket. And the one thing I always tell people, you're always better off making as much money as you can as long as the tax bracket is less than 100%. And although the tax brackets have been quite high during our lifetime, in the early 60s, they were as high as 90%. That's only on income above a certain level. Your first $8,000 for everybody, regardless of whether you make $8,000 or $80 million, the first $8,000 is only taxed at 10%.
Okay, now our listeners, beginning career, mid-career, if they find a tax deduction, then one of the best would be the thrift. And I'm always a little surprised about the people that don't maximize it. I clearly understand that some can't maximize it because it takes away from their disposable income and they need it.
Sure.
But the next dollar in, if they haven't maximized it, is going to receive a substantial tax benefit at the federal and probably at the state. Not all states have state income tax returns, and not all states allow the thrift deduction, Pennsylvania being one of them. Point being is they stretch, and that money goes someplace. I'm not saying buy a bigger house just to get a bigger mortgage, but if it's got economic ramifications like the thrift or something else that might be tax-deferred, seems to make sense, but you got to understand it.
Yes, you do.
And as one of our guests, Joe Sullender, he said it once, maybe a year or two ago, and he said, Planning is a succession of moving parts. Now, to be fair, the engine that drives a lot of our listeners is federal benefits. You got to understand your benefits. Second, finance and tax, probably finance first, taxes second, but taxes always need to be whispered into the ears. You know, why are you doing this? And so at the end of the day, then you've got these three gears in sync, but if you wait too long to put them into sync, it's pretty hard to do.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Bob. And I, as you know, I occasionally teach tax planning and in some seminars for federal employees. And when I do,
occasionally,
I always start the same way. I give the same example, and the example is as follows: if you take $1 and you double it every year for 20 years, at the end of 20 years, you will have $1,048,000. And then step two is you take the same dollar. And once again, you're going to double it every year for 20 years. But this time, you're going to pay 28% income tax on each increase in value. And I use 28% because that's many times the effective tax rate of many federal employees at both the state and federal level. But if you do that, you take the same dollar, you double it every year, and you pay 28% income tax, at the end of 20 years, you'll have a little more than $51,000. A 28% tax rate takes an investment that could have been worth more than $1 million and turns it into $50,000. Now, I don't mean to suggest to anybody that I have an investment for you that's going to double every year. I mean, anybody that promises you that may get lucky occasionally, but it's probably pie in the sky.
I was about to tell Andrew it's time to go and listen to Tom's investment advice.
Well, that's not the purpose of the example. I don't have an investment that's going to double every year. The only reason I give that example is to illustrate to people that if you go through life and you ignore the impact of taxes on everyday financial decisions you make, you're going to have a whole lot less money available to you. And one of the reasons why we're talking about what could happen at the end of this year is that people tell me all the time, the Bush tax cuts only helped the rich people. Well, they did help the rich people, and maybe more so than everybody else, but they helped everybody else too. They lowered everybody's tax rate. And unless you're aware that the tax rates are going to change, they could adversely impact you. And there's some steps you can take to possibly minimize that adverse impact on your own personal situation.
I liked what you did too. You picked the middle of the road tax rate. We're not just talking to the one percenters. They're probably not even in today's discussion. This is the federal employee, mid-beginning, mid-career, pre-retirement. Pre-retirement, and they need to understand they're probably in a higher bracket, but we're really focusing in on the power of, and as John Elliott always quotes with Albert Einstein, the miracle of compounding. So if you can get someplace and compound without taxes, somebody else is going to say, yeah, but you had to pay tax to get the money into the thrift in advance. Sure you did, but time, value of money, etc. But that's another show, another day. Now, we are available for call-ins. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. It's about 10:20 a.m. It's June 4th, 2012. We'll be on for another half hour plus. Please don't call us after 11 o'clock today because we won't be here. But you can email us. We'll talk about the email in a bit. But take advantage of having Tom. 202-465-3080. All righty, so we talked about this, and then there's another, I don't know that it's fact, but I read about it, that 50% of the population don't pay income taxes.
I've read that same thing, and I assume it's based on a study, but it's really kind of stunning. I know we were having a conversation beforehand with our engineer, and he said, what? That can't be true. But it really is. Many people don't pay income taxes, And that's because of a variety of exemptions, credits, standard deduction, personal exemptions, excludability many times for folks who get Social Security. If your income is below a certain level, your Social Security is not taxable. But roughly half the people in the United States don't have to pay income taxes.
And I'm glad you said that, because your point here is these are people that would pay taxes, but they don't have to pay taxes. We're not talking about the tax cheats. We're talking about somebody that would otherwise file a return if it weren't for this exception, that exception, this exception. I don't know if you remember, there was something called the Reagan tax cuts in 1986, and there were Clinton tax cuts in the late 70s or late 90s. And the Reagan tax cuts were cut. It was kind of a give and a get. And the give was, listen, we're going to give you lower tax brackets, but the get the government got, people may remember this, they could deduct interest on the purchase of an automobile. They could deduct interest on credit cards. They could deduct interest on
State
and local income taxes. They could deduct sales taxes. And Congress said, listen, we're just going to clear out a lot of the gunk, but in exchange for it, we're going to give you a lower tax bracket. And I'll be very honest, I was really nervous at that time that I would have to become a real accountant and do audit work, not tax audit work, and it scared me. Fortunately, I won't say fortunately because it's just way too complicated. It's 20 times harder than it ever was in 86 currently.
Well, one of the things that's going to be changed if nothing happens between now and the end of this year is who can claim the earned income credit is going to change. And one of the reasons they changed it as part of the Bush tax cuts was to make it simpler. Now, you only qualify for the earned income credit if you have a pretty low income. And many federal employees are never going to qualify for it because they make too much money. But if the law changes, how you compute that earned income credit is going to be much more complicated. So the tax code is not only complicated for people who can afford to hire high-priced lawyers and accountants, it affects everybody. And anybody who does their own tax return over the last few years has realized that it can be just unbelievably complicated.
I think you've just given a financial planning tip. But should invest in computer software companies that write tax programs.
Well, I think.
And then let's see, how long does it take to become $1 million if I put it in my IRA? Sorry, Tom.
So, well, it can take a while, but it certainly is something that one of the studies that I see all the time. It really would be very easy to raise the same amount of revenue that we currently raise, or even more, if we simplified the tax code by eliminating, quote, loopholes, close quote. But the two biggest loopholes that cost the government the most money are the mortgage interest deduction and the fact that any health insurance that your employer pays for is not included in your income. So if we eliminate those two tax benefits, the rates could be significantly lowered, but it would also adversely affect probably everybody who's listening to this radio show. Anybody who, for whom the government pays any part of their health insurance, would see their amount of their taxable income increase. Anybody who claims a deduction for home mortgage interest would lose the benefit of that deduction. So, as you said, it's easy to simplify the tax code. The problem is many people don't want to deal with the consequences of simplification.
Well, the tax code's gotten to where it is by each year there was a little carrot given each year, and now we got too many carrots. And one of these would impact, and today's show is to talk to our listeners, child tax credit. If you have a child and your income is below a certain level, then you get a $1,000 credit. Now, listeners, a credit is a dollar-for-dollar reduction of your taxes. It's not like the tax brackets Tom and I were talking about earlier.
It's a lot better than a deduction.
Yeah, but that's $1,000 given back to you, but if these expire, that becomes $500. Still, it's nice to have the $500, but it's really bad to lose the $500.
Yeah. And once again, that's a tax deduction. That's a tax benefit. It's not going to affect the rich, because if you're rich, you don't get the tax credit. But it's going to affect everyday Joes.
All right, another thing that I believe a number of people invest in, not so much in the thrift. We're talking about outside the thrift. Somebody might buy stock. It's very hard to pick stock. Some people are good at it. Most are not. But the ones that aren't, they like mutual funds. Why?
Sure.
Because it's entrusted to somebody that knows the market better than what the individual investor does. And there are even different types of mutual funds or mutual funds for people that are tax sensitive, where there's not as much activity in the mutual fund, and there are people that like the go-go aspect of it, but they will pay tax. But here's the key. The current tax rate on a buy and sell of a stock, whether it's inside of a mutual fund or the individual owns it, it's very low. It's 15% at the federal level, plus whatever it is at the state. There's no state benefit for capital, what they call capital gains. But that would change to be probably 20%. And they were talking about extending the period of time that one would have to hold it. Currently, if you buy something like that and you hold it for at least a year and you sell it at a profit, then the tax rate is fairly low. It's 15% federal and, again, whatever the state. Well, if they change not only the 15 to 20 and then they extend the hold period to 5 years, the investors should be aware of that. And these investors could be at any level.
That's right, because we both regularly deal with lots of federal employees who either buy stock or, as you said, more commonly, maybe invest in mutual funds. So what do you do about that? Well, if you know the rate of tax is going to increase by 5% at the end of this year, one of the things you might want to think about doing is sell that stock before the end of this year. But as we both always tell people, you never do anything solely for tax reasons.
Ever.
It's almost always a bad decision. But what you can do is, if you really like, and this may be a bad example, Facebook stock, let's say Facebook comes back and goes way up in value, you can sell it by the end of the year, pay tax on your gain. Well, Facebook's a bad example because it hasn't been out. You won't have been able to have held it for a full year. But if you have stock that has gone up in value, you can sell it by the end of this year, pay tax at a rate of 15%, and buy it right back if you think it's a good investment. I know there are rules that limit your ability to deduct losses when you sell stock if you buy it back right away, but those rules don't apply to gains. Uncle Sam is always happy when you realize a gain and pay taxes on it. So if you think a particular stock is a really good investment that you want to hold for the long term, but you have a gain now that you want to lock in, you can do that by the end of the year.
Alrighty, there's another a thing that's vexing to most people. So this comment is probably designed at the late mid-career, early pre-retirement. It's called the alternative minimum tax. And if you try to explain that to people, it's just very hard. But basically what it says is, if we don't get you this way, we'll get you that way. It's alternative minimums, so everybody pays a minimum tax. In its inception, it was a good idea because people abused the tax law, and this was an alternative way to get them. But now it impacts families. It impacts people that have mortgage interest deductions. They might live in a state that has high state income taxes. But if they change that, I'm not so sure they generate any more revenue, because the income tax rate's still going to be X, and the alt min might be higher, but it's not going to change anything. That's my gut.
Oh, I agree with you. I see that all the time. People scrupulously save every receipt they can find, and they claim every deduction they can find, and they lower their tax rates, and they go to somebody like you, or they use TurboTax, and then they see, well, what's this alternative minimum tax? That's something that applies to rich people. It doesn't apply to me. And in fact, there was a case that went to the U.S. tax court about 5 years ago, and the individual was a federal employee, and he computed his taxes by using TurboTax, and he saw that it generated an alternative minimum tax liability. So he wrote a letter to the IRS and said, this can't apply to me. I'm a federal employee. I'm not rich. It was never intended to apply to me. And he cited legislative history, and he really did his homework. And the IRS said, no, it's a matter of computation. If you compute your tax and you claim certain tax benefits, whether you're rich or not, you got to pay it. So the guy contested it. He went to court, and you know the result. He lost. And what what the U.S. tax court said is, yes, when the alternative minimum tax was implemented, it was designed to make sure everybody paid their minimal fair share. But it's strictly based on a computation. And many folks that were never intended to come within the scope of the alternative minimum tax are now impacted by it.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say the alternative minimum tax has been around since, I think, the mid to late 70s. But it really popped its head out with the Bush tax cuts. I'm not blaming the Bush tax cuts on it, but what they did is they cut the regular income tax, but they never changed the alternative minimum tax, so it reached out and hit more people. Now, if they reverse that, then I don't know that it generates... Smarter minds than mine are on Capitol Hill.
Right.
And so when they change, I would hope. And when they change,
don't count on it.
When they change these laws, I don't know how they build into that, because if they up the income tax and they reduce the alt min tax, nobody made a cent more. So that to me is going to be an interesting calculation. Let's get away from that, because that makes people's eyes glaze over. But there's things that are near and dear to people's heart that are saving for college. This might be a married individual, might be a single individual. It doesn't make any difference. One of these things is called a Coverdale. It used to be called an IRA, but it's a non-deductible way to put money away for college, and it would be tax sheltered for some future date. Well, what happens if that goes away? That would affect a broad spectrum of people.
It affects a lot of people. It affects anybody who's saving for college, because it cuts the amount you can put in. I believe the current amount you can put in is $2,000 per year, and that's going to drop to $500 per year. And it's to anybody. It's not only rich people. It's everybody, regardless of where your income comes from. So that's going to be something that adversely affects people. And the one deduction, that this wasn't part of the Bush tax cuts, but the one tax benefit that has affected everybody who has any earned income at all, they're paying a lower rate of FICA tax, Social Security tax. Now, as of, I believe, about 2 years ago, everybody paid tax of 6.2% on their earned income, and that went to fund Social Security benefits. About 2 years ago, in order to help jumpstart the economy, that rate was cut by 2%. And it came into the law. It applied for the first time in 2011. It was extended for 2012. But unless Congress does something between now and the end of the year, everybody who has any earned income is going to see a 2% income tax increase, and that applies to anybody. I believe next year the Social Security limit is going to be around $113,000. So if you earn $113,000 and that benefit is not extended, that means your taxes are going to go up by about $2,200 next year. So it affects everybody. These tax changes are not only changes that affect people who are very well off.
And another one, we're talking about student loan interest. I mean,
right.
That's in the paper today, yesterday, last week, more so than ever. Student loans, well, student loans carry with it an interest. And it is deductible if one's income, everything is hinged upon one's income, doesn't exceed a certain amount. If it exceeds a certain amount, then it starts to get phased out. If this law is allowed to lapse, it'll go back to the old law, and it'll be very hard for, I would say, most mid-career type folks to be able to get this deduction.
Right.
Maybe the kids, when they get out of school, would have a chance for a while, but not for a long while.
Well, many times the people who benefit from that are the people who graduate from college, actually get a job, and which is a problem right now for many young folks, is finding a job. But if they do, at least they can deduct that interest. Their ability to do so could be limited if the Bush tax cuts expire.
Okay, there's some other things in here. Currently, I believe we're still under the payroll tax cut.
Where
That would go away. That's probably going to go away anyway, I would imagine.
Well, I mean, that's one that's always puzzled me. There's a great deal of concern about the long-term solvency of Social Security. Are we going to have enough money to be able to pay the benefits we promised to people? And if we're concerned about having enough money to pay them, I would think we would not want to decrease the tax that funds those benefits, but we did.
Okay, there's another one here. It's not necessarily for everybody, but it's not out there in the stratosphere. Teachers' classroom expense deduction. It's really an adjustment. But it's small, but let's say budget's tight at the state or the county level, and the teacher feels compelled to spend some money to provide supplies for the kids in class, and now they get a tax deduction for it.
Right.
I don't know that it's an incentive just to get the tax deduction, but it was at least made them feel better.
Well,
that could go away.
Most of the teachers that do it because they're good, conscientious
exactly.
teachers. They need it. They can't get their school system to buy it, so they spend $20 or $50. And now, if they do that, they get a deduction up to certain limits. That's not going to apply anymore.
All right. Another one is somebody, you bought your first home. I bought my first home. Andrew bought his first home. And we maybe didn't have a ton of money to put down on it. And we paid a mortgage insurance premium, if you will. And you could get a deduction up until the end of this year. I'd imagine this is going to go away.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that does go away. And Bob, I think the point that you are making by running through the laundry list of changes is that when there's talk about repealing the Bush tax cuts, please don't just assume that's not going to affect me because I'm not rich, because that would be an incorrect assumption. These changes affect everybody. Now, in fairness, what we need to say is when he was running for the presidency, President Obama said he did not want to raise taxes on anybody who had income below $200,000 per year. And he's been consistent in saying that. Members of Congress who disagree with him say, we don't want to increase taxes on anybody, because if we divert income that's currently being spent and it goes into the government, number one, the government may not spend it wisely, but number two, whether it spends it wisely or not, that money is not available to be spent in the economy, and it's going to have an adverse impact on an economy which is already struggling. So I guess the real problem is that all of these changes will happen unless an agreement is reached between the president and Congress. And so far, the track record of the president and Congress reaching agreement on fiscal issues hasn't been great.
Right. And that's not a political statement. It's reality.
No, it is reality.
Right. Another thing that could impact our listeners with children in I won't say college or higher education, if you will. There's something called a HOPE credit and a lifetime learning credit, just to drive you crazy. Now, again, for those listening, if you get a credit and you spend a dollar, you save a dollar in taxes.
That's right.
It's a one-to-one relationship. It's different than a tax deduction. But these were very nice with tuition being as high as it is for whatever. It could be trade school, if
right.
I'm not mistaken. It could be
it could be virtually
college.
Anything yeah. beyond high school.
Yeah. And that would get skinnied down.
Yep.
And you know, again, that would, I would say, would impact a broader, you know, the midsection.
Yeah, it affects, I think it applies to people who have incomes of below like $110,000 a year. So, I mean, if you're very well off, you don't get these benefits, but it is a benefit that applies to many people who are not terribly well off.
Right. And it would also impact things like child care credits. Again, we're talking about people with children. Not everybody has children, but probably more do than don't. I hope I don't get in trouble and get some hate emails for that one, but
yeah.
Probably more do than don't. And you just need to be aware. We're not doomsday here, but just be aware that when you see these things in the press, you know, will this happen? Everything Tom and I have talked about is guaranteed not 100% to happen, but there might be, well, it won't be a total obliteration of this provision, but it'll be a smaller provision, just to say we didn't knock it out.
Right.
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 And then, you know, to play to your strong hand, federal estate and gift tax. You know, for the people listening, people think of others that have an estate that they're just extremely well off. Well, they're generally not poor, but a lot of people are hit by it that are not anticipating being hit, and this would probably bring down that somewhat. But now I'm in the deep end of the pool, and I need a lifeguard, Tom.
Well, the federal estate tax exemption right now and for the last several years has been $5 million per person. Well, when most people hear that, they figure, okay, that doesn't apply to me, and it probably doesn't. But at the end of this year, unless Congress does something, the estate tax exemption drops from $5 million per person to $1 million per person. And the rate of tax increases from 35% to a maximum of 55%. Now, Bob, $1 million is a lot of money. But I regularly deal with many federal employees who have estates that are worth more than $1 million. Now, they may not have a net worth of more than $1 million, but net worth and estate tax liability are two different things. For example, if you have Fegley life insurance and you have $200,000 worth of coverage, that doesn't add a nickel to your net worth. It's not worth anything as long as you're alive. But if you were to die and that insurance pays off, that's fully included in your gross estate. Virtually all of the benefits that federal employees have that add to their estate are things they can't spend right now. For example, most federal employees have money in a thrift plan. And for many of them, they have lots of money in a thrift plan. Well, they can't spend that money right now. All federal employees have a retirement plan. They can't spend that money now, but it's going to provide a lifetime stream of income. Many folks own a home. Home can be a wonderful asset. If you've owned a home in a major metropolitan area over the last 20 or 30 years, you've seen it increase in value anywhere from 1% to 10 times. Well, now, the market's been a little slow in recent years, but for most people who have owned homes for a long time, they've gone up in value. All of those assets are assets that you can't spend right now. You may still live paycheck to paycheck, but when you add up all those things like life insurance and TSP and retirement benefits and your house, you may well have an estate that is worth more than $1 million. And an example I use all the time, if the estate tax does drop to back to $1 million, and you have a federal employee couple that between both the husband and the wife, their total assets are worth $1.5 million, they're going to have an estate tax liability of about $235,000. That's real money. And there are steps you can take to minimize the impact of all those taxes.
Tom, I need to understand this. Almost from birth, I probably started working at 12. So the first 12 years, I was tax-free.
That's right.
And then upon my final day here on Earth, I've paid taxes for all these years. And then when I pass, they're going to not get me. They're going to get what's left behind.
That's right, Bob.
Oh my gosh!
You may have heard of something called the hand of taxes. I have people tell me all the time, "Well, that's double taxation. They can't do that." I said, "Yes, they can." And in fact, the hand of taxes is as follows: Number one, you're taxed when you earn it. That's called the income tax. Number two, once you earn the income, pay taxes on it. You use that money to buy something, and you pay a sales tax. That's the second tax you pay. Number three, you use it to buy a home or other piece of property. You're taxed every year on the value of that property by the county or city where you live. That's called the real estate tax. You give it away. You're taxed when you give it away. That's called the gift tax. And then five, you pay the estate tax when you die. That represents the hand. It accounts for all five figures. And if, like you and I, you live in Maryland and you leave it to somebody other than your spouse or one of your children, you also pay the inheritance taxes. So for those of you who think that your income can't be taxed twice, I got bad news for you. It can be taxed as many as six times.
So if I'm in a poker game with you, Tom, and you're the government, and I don't like aces for whatever reason, and I just keep handing you the aces, at the end of the day, you got five aces.
That's right.
And so your hand can get more money from me.
That's right.
Now I understand.
That's right. Now, one of the things that I want to make clear, none of this is the doing of the Internal Revenue Service. In fact, I really feel sorry for the IRS because they've got to administer this law. And right now, what we're doing is we're telling the IRS, IRS, we want you to administer the law and collect these taxes next year, but we're not sure what we want you to collect. They don't know what the law is going to be, and they're being told they've got to administer a law that they don't know what it's going to be. And This same thing happened in 2010 when Congress made some last-minute changes. And when I say last-minute, it was like in December. It was after the election. There was a lame duck session. And they made a number of very significant tax changes. And IRS had to delay the filing season by about 6 weeks in order to implement the changes that Congress didn't put into effect until 2 weeks before the end of the year.
All righty, so... We saw that this past filing season, the 2012-2011 return, there were some things that, like the alt-min patch, they couldn't process returns, the IRS. And I'm glad you said that about them, and we're not self-serving to the IRS. They have a bad job.
Yeah.
Most of them like it. I've met very few that abuse the power, and I've met a few in private industry that abuse the power, but most of them are not bad folks. They just have a bad job, and they have to be tough. And unfortunately, they have to be tough to somebody that doesn't understand what they're talking about.
Right. I am very sympathetic to folks who work for the IRS. As you know, I spent the first 10 years of my professional career working for IRS. And I still have a number of friends, although most of my friends are now reaching retirement age. But it is a very difficult job. And as you said, 99.9% of them are extremely conscientious in doing their job.
Yeah, and we might. Oh, good. We have a caller. Good morning. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Bob. John Elliott. And hi, Tom.
Hey, Bob. John. How are you?
John Elliott. Nice
good.
To talk to you.
I got a tax question from an emailer. He's a law enforcement officer who left at age 50 with 25 years of service, and then the TSP early withdrawal question came up, and I cited the Thrift Savings Plan fact sheet, which tells us that law enforcement officers are not treated any differently than regular employees if they leave before 55, and the only way to avoid the 10% tax penalty is one, purchase a life annuity, or monthly payments based on the IRS life expectancy tables. Well, he said he contacted someone at IRS who says there's the Qualified Public Safety Employee Act, and it's described in IRS publications 575 and 590. He thinks he's not restricted to just those two withdrawal options to avoid the penalty, and I was wondering if either of you tax experts have ever heard of that.
I sure have. Now, follow me along with this. A number of years ago, there was an exception made for public safety officers. Key is officers. And they were afforded an additional tax deduction based on health care premiums against their...
Right.
Okay?
Right.
But the key is... they were public safety officers. Along comes another law, and they couldn't use the term public safety officers. They changed the word to public safety employees.
Uh-huh.
You get my focus? It's on the third word.
Okay.
Public safety employees are not federal employees. They're state and local.
Uh-huh.
And there was a special provision passed for them, but not for the feds.
Okay, which he is.
I know, and I've had the same thing in class, and he get very mad at me. I said, listen, I don't write this, but I do have to warn you that if you do this and you feel that you're entitled to it, you're not. And I like what you said, John. There's another remedy to it that I won't say does away with it, but they're affectionately called the 72T rules. John had a much better term for it, substantially equal payments. But actually under 72T, and for those listening, that's the IRS code, and I hate code section numbers, but it's also a website, 72T, and go to it. There are three different ways to calculate it, and you'll find that one of them is particularly attractive to you, and you're not stuck with it for the rest of your life. You would have to stay on it for at least 5 years or until you hit 59 and a half. So your emailer would, at 50, have to stay on this for 59 and a half, but will like the opportunity because they don't have the opportunity under public safety employees. Sorry.
Well, good. Well, I pointed out to him that the Thrift Savings Plan tax sheet was updated as recently as last month to accommodate the Roth stuff. But the exemptions for leaving before 55 had remained unchanged, which I thought indicated to me, I mean, the TSP is pretty sharp, and they wouldn't, if there had been a change in the tax law that pertained to law enforcement, federal law enforcement officers, they would have added that to the exceptions, and they clearly didn't. So I told him I would contact a qualified tax professional, and I pointed out the recent update to the tax sheet at TSP.gov, and I said, I'm skeptical that you can avoid the penalty by just taking equal monthly payments not pegged to your life expectancy, which is what he wants to do.
No, good. Your bullseye with your response to him.
And John, he's going to tell you that doesn't make sense.
All right.
And the answer I always give to people is it doesn't have to make sense. It's the law.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I hope he takes my advice and just doesn't go by what he thought the IRS was saying.
Why don't you do this, John? If you happen to still have his email, just say, listen, I was listening to the show this morning. Google public safety employees and see if you qualify. Just Google
it. Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, I also maybe get him to listen to the show, which will be archived in a day or so.
Great.
So he can...
He should listen to the whole show, but you could tell him this was towards the end.
right. Okay. Well, that's very helpful.
Okay.
And, good show.
Thank you.
Thanks for that advice.
All right. Bye. Good talking with you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Those are the kind of issues, Bob, that can drive people crazy. The distinction, they say, well, you're just mincing words. And that's true.
Well, that's what they did. See, they couldn't use the same terminology. Yeah. The problem is they should have changed the first words.
Yeah.
It still says public safety, but I got caught in that when it first came out. And I said, this just doesn't make sense. And then I go, oh, two different words in the third word. Yeah. And then I drilled down and Fed need not apply.
Yeah, that's just an indication of how complex the tax code can be.
All righty. And if we're talking about, we'd like to stay away from complexity for complexity's sake. John's call was perfect to demystify the complexity. But here's the other one. The thrift, and I don't know if people are aware of this, they're not aware of it in class, but the Thrift Savings Board plan changed all their forms in April.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so people are talking about using the transfer. I said, do not use the old one. Use the April 2012 one. Because they had to include Roth in all the forms now. Because
right.
It wasn't included before. And their publications as well. So, and it's very easy. You can just go on Google and TSP 60, TSP 70, whatever. Or you can go to the website itself. Sometimes it takes a ID, but I would imagine any Fed would have an ID to get in. I don't.
Yeah. Well, I would assume all the current forms are available on TSP's website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As well as the publications.
Right.
And they're harder only because of the addition of the Roth TSP, which we've done two shows on. May 4th and another one, excuse me. Yeah, May 4th and another one, May 11th. May 4th was a very simple one. May 11th was the director of the thrift, a tax attorney, and the director of external affairs. So it was a good show. Anyway, so let's come on back to the things that are going to be skinny down. Again, the thrust of the show is not for the wailing wall, oh, poor me, what's going to happen? If it does happen, be aware, track it. You're not going to read about it every week. Probably shouldn't read about it every week. As it gets closer to the end, start to pay more attention because that's when all the kind of here, if you're going to get this, this is what I want, stuff is done, and things start moving through the houses.
Yeah, in all likelihood, if you start watching this stuff too closely right now, whatever you hear is going to change in the future because Congress simply is not focusing on this now. And most folks that I talk to that are somewhat knowledgeable in how the tax legislation gets enacted tell me if something happens, it'll probably be in a lame duck session after the election when the president calls the Congress back or possibly even early next year. and changes may be retroactive. So unless Congress does surprise us and does pass a tax bill before they adjourn for the two conventions, the nominating conventions, in all likelihood, nothing will get done until after the election.
So if we were to summarize what we've done, we've talked about different things that can happen. We didn't talk about things that will happen. And probably everybody's going to pay more tax, but their tax isn't going to go up 20%. But no. It is going to go up, but it takes it out of their pocket, like you say, too.
Right.
Just, you know, we need to be aware of that and plan. The other comment you made, a lot of people on Social Security, if Social Security is the prime income source, they don't pay much in tax. But that is extremely sensitive to income. So that I've had clients that had Social Security and maybe were taxed at the mid-level, and then they took an IRA distribution out and it kicked up their income, and their taxes went up disproportionately because now more of their Social Security. I know I'm making some people's hair hurt, but for those that are on that borderline, be really careful when you take money out of taxable pots.
Well, I mean, that's good advice for anybody who has money in a tax-deferred account. When you start taking distributions, you need to be careful. One other thing I want to mention, Bob, and it sort of relates to John's question, and it's not the topic we talked about today, is one of the things I consistently tell federal employees in seminars that I teach. When you retire, before you start taking withdrawals from the thrift plan, you either need to consult with a knowledgeable tax advisor or make sure you know what the rules are. Don't simply take a distribution and figure, well, I'm a law enforcement officer. I can retire at age 50, so I'm going to take all my money out. So be careful when you do that.
Okay, so how do we get in touch with you real fast, Tom?
Okay, you can get in touch with me by email. My email is T-O-R-O-U-R-K-E, at Miles, M-I-L-E-S, Stockbridge, Stockbridge.com.
Enough said. Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure. Thanks, Andrew. And we'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.